I'm Eric Jorgensen, and earlier this year, I sat down at the Heathman Hotel with Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, of course, is the renowned ethologist, world-famous scientist, and one of the most outspoken advocates for atheism. He is the author of many books, including the 2006 bestseller, The God Delusion. His most recent book is The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. Please stay tuned to hear my conversation with Richard Dawkins.
Your new book is The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence of Evolution. You've referred to it as the missing link, so to speak, in your oeuvre. What do you mean by that? What prompted you to write the book, and who did you write it for?
It's only a missing link in the sense that I've written a lot of books about other aspects of evolution before, but they've always assumed that it's true. And I've never actually laid out the evidence that it's true, and that's what this is. But I hope it'll be just as interesting as any of my other books. And I mean, the subject matter of the evidence for evolution is exciting and enthralling.
Is there one particular piece of evidence that you find especially compelling, perhaps to someone who still resists the idea of evolution as being true, that you would present them with?
I think the evidence from molecular genetics, the comparative study of molecular genetics, it's so persuasive. Since genes are digital information, that means you can actually look at texts side by side, exactly as you might look at two versions of the same book of the Bible or something, and compare them as a scholar would, word by word, letter by letter. And when you do that, it is extremely strong evidence, because the pattern of resemblances is exactly what you would expect if they had evolved. So it's very, very persuasive. It works. If you take one gene and you do it, and you get a hierarchical tree, a pattern of life which resembles and indeed is a family tree. And then you do the same thing for another gene, and it shows you the same family tree. And a third gene, it shows you the same family tree. The only alternative to it being a family tree is that God deliberately set it up in order to deceive us.
Do you think that part of the reason that so many people are still so opposed to evolution is simply because they don't understand it, and they don't understand...
Yes, I do think that, and I think that's, in a way, encouraging, because that's easy to rectify. All you have to do is read the book.
And the people who do read the book and still cling to their old beliefs, why do you think that is?
I don't know of any examples of such. I think the people who cling to their own to their old beliefs, when those beliefs are biblical, don't on the whole read books, except one.
Was there anything that you learned while writing this book that was just especially exciting?
Oh, well, yes. I learned... the most interesting thing I learned was perhaps the work of Richard Lenski of Michigan State University on bacterial evolution, which I thought was extremely interesting. Beautifully done work. He set up sort of experimental setup in which the bacteria were free to evolve under fairly controlled conditions. But the beauty of bacteria, of course, is that they have such short generation times that
you can
pack an awful lot of evolution into a human lifetime.
Right.
And the other beauty of them, which he exploited, was that you can lay down your own fossil record. That's to say, you can deep freeze them. And so at any time, you can pick out a sample of bacteria, put them in the freezer, and keep them. And then that is a fossil of, say, generation 1,000. And then when you get to generation 20,000, you can say, well, I wonder how these compare with those we had with generation 1,000. And you unfreeze them, and they just carry on living and reproducing and evolving exactly as if nothing had happened.
That seems to me like especially compelling evidence, given that so many, at least of the people who are proponents of creationism or intelligent design that I've come across, often say things like, well, if evolution is true, why isn't it happening? And why
can't
we see it?
Yes.
And of course, and you respond by saying, well, we just don't live so long. And in your book, you talk about sort of the crime scene analogy where we can't see the murder, but we can put the evidence together.
Yes.
But bacteria.
You actually can see it, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, precisely.
What are the now big looming questions that we still have yet to answer about evolution, and what are we doing to try to solve them?
Well, I think sex is a good one. Nobody really understands why sex evolved. I think consciousness is a big one. It's somehow just thought as a purely a philosophical question, but it's an evolutionary question. I mean, how does, you know, how widespread is it in the animal kingdom? How many times has it evolved? What even is it? What's its biological advantage? The origin of life, which is before evolution started, is a very important gap in our knowledge. Nobody knows how it started. We know the kind of process it must have been, but we don't know how it happened. That would be a very nice gap to plug.
The theory of evolution does leave a lot of kind of gaping philosophical questions, like if all of this is us adapting by reacting to things that are happening around us, where does things like free will play into that? If we could start all over and start evolution again from the beginning for this world that we're living in now, would it have happened the exact same way?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yes. I have thought about that a bit. Obviously, nobody knows.
Right.
We can get a certain handle on it by looking at little local rerunnings. You can see it in Australia, for example, the Australian mammal fauna, which is a kind of rerun, actually a contemporary run, but separate but an isolated run, of mammal evolution, to which we can compare the parallel process of mammal evolution that was going on in the old world, and actually also in the new world, in South America, after Gondwana split up. So the mammal fauna of Australia is similar but different. It's all marsupials, but the range of marsupials that were produced is kind of uncannily reminiscent of the range of placentals, mammals that were produced after the dinosaurs went extinct in the old world, and the range of placentals and marsupials that were produced in South America at the same time. So you can see that you get something sort of similar, but not identical.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were to go back to the very beginning and run it again, or say go back to the first eukaryotic cell after bacteria, the first of our kind of cell, would you get, if you ran it again, things like arthropods, things like mollusks, things like fish, things like mammals? Interesting question, and we can go some way to answering it by looking at parallels in different places. My hunch is you probably would get something pretty similar, but very, very far from identical. I mean, there are some people who even think you'd get humans. I don't think that. That would be asking too much, but something sort of you might get something a bit like vertebrates.
I've heard that theories before, proposed by not necessarily that he totally thinks this is true, Daniel Dennett among some other people, that perhaps even the very basic fundamentals of the universe are evolving in sort of a way, so that maybe the Big Bang happened billions of times over.
Yes. Well, this is quite fashionable among physicists, actually, because it arises from the observation, which is accepted at least by some physicists, that the constants of physics, the sort of half dozen or so numbers, which physicists have no explanation for, but just simply can measure.
The speed of light, perhaps? Or
Yes, the gravitational constant, the strong force, that kind of thing. It has been said that if any of these constants were ever so slightly different, the universe would be so different that we couldn't have evolved. And so this gives rise to the suspicion that the constants of the universe are finely tuned to bring us into existence. Some people see that as an argument for theism. It's not a very good argument for theism because it leaves open the question of where did the tuner come from. We're left with just as big a problem. The anthropic principle is an interesting alternative to the theistic answer. The anthropic principle suggests that because we are here observing the universe, we have to be in the kind of universe that could give rise to us. Well, just saying that is not totally satisfying because it still leaves open the question of why is it so finely tuned? Admittedly, it had to be or we wouldn't be here. And so one could say that our being here determines that it was so. But that's not satisfying to me anyway, and certainly not to some other people. A more satisfying way to put it is the one that with which you introduced the question, which is that this is only one of billions of universes. There's a sort of bubbling foam of universes, and each bubble has its own laws and constants, and only a minority of those bubbles has what it takes to give rise to evolution and life. And then we have to be in one of the minority of universes. That's a satisfying version of the anthropic principle. One physicist, Lee Smolin, has made it even more Darwinian sounding. It already sounds a bit Darwinian. He's made it even more Darwinian sounding by suggesting that you actually get evolution of universes. That universes give birth to daughter universes. He suggests that the moment of birth is a black hole. And at that moment of birth, the fundamental constants may mutate, I mean, may be slightly different from that of the mother universe. And certain combinations of fundamental constants are better at making universes that are good at giving birth to daughter universes. That if that were true, then you would indeed get proper Darwinian selection of universes towards universes that are good at giving birth to daughter universes. And at least some of the qualities that a universe needs in order to be good at making babies, they happen to be the same qualities you need to make life. And the most obvious one would be they got to last long enough. Universes that fizzle out within the first picosecond aren't going to have time for evolution to come about. So, and there one can make a similar case for some of the other constants as well.
The other way that the universe exists and it evolved, or this particular world in such a way that we were able to observe it, seems to have a certain beauty in it. And you also address this in the last chapter of your book, and so does Darwin in the last chapter of Origin of Species, this idea that, you know, this incredibly complex evolution that human consciousness has come to the point that we can observe and enjoy and recognize. The beauty of this is, in fact, rather lovely and gives evolution that thing that so many religious people think that it's vacant of.
I think it's lovely, yes. I agree with you. Yeah.
Well, I got the invitation that you sent to everyone.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to my conversation with Richard Dawkins. I'm Eric Jorgensen, and I spoke to Richard Dawkins earlier this year at the Heathman Hotel. Richard Dawkins is a world-famous scientist, author of many popular science books. He recently retired from his position as the Simonian Professor for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. Please stay tuned for the rest of our conversation.
Your book comes out this year, which is, of course, the bicentennial of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species. Do you think, obviously we've made tremendous scientific progress since then, but do you think we've made much progress in the way of having evolution be socially accepted. You said that 40% of Americans don't believe in evolution.
We don't seem to be making as much progress as we should. And I think partly we are to blame for not going out there and talking more, and scientists should do that. But mostly it's religious propaganda, which is motivated, goodness knows by what, to thwart, systematically and deliberately thwart, with organizations that are well-organized, well-financed, tax-free, to subvert science. And that's what's happening in America at the moment.
I've even, from my own experience, growing up in a very religious community, even though it was mandated by the state that evolution be taught, none of the science teachers would do it because they were all Christians themselves. But they also couldn't teach creation. So instead, we all just had to write an essay about how we thought the world was created. And that was the entire...
How anybody can teach biology without talking about evolution, I do not know. I mean, cell biology, biochemistry, ecology... How can you teach students a subject where you leave out the fundamental theorem of the subject that makes sense of it all? It must just seem like a rigmarole of disconnected, disjointed facts.
Indeed.
What an appalling way to teach. What a scandal that there are such lousy teachers.
This is especially a problem in America. I understand that in Britain it's not quite as bad.
It's getting worse.
It's getting worse.
Yes.
Why is that, do you think?
The intimidation of teachers, I think, feeling teachers feel understandably demoralized by seeing students coming in with skeptical expressions and refusing to listen. This is mostly because of the Muslim influx into Britain.
Do you think the situation in Britain has been affected by what I see as sort of a revival of extreme fundamental Christian belief systems in the United States, especially?
Yes, a certain amount of that, a certain amount of infection of that virus has come across, yes.
Mm-hmm. So now that we're in this situation in this country, and as I'm sure you well know, it gets violent at times and just completely absurd, what can we do? What can people who are atheists, who feel very strongly that creationism should not be part of the schools, what should we be doing?
Well, it's not just atheists who feel strongly that creationism should not be part of the schools. It's bishops, theologians, priests who are educated and who understand that the evidence is overwhelming and who are just as upset about the fundamentalist creationists as we are.
Francis Collins, who was recently appointed by the Obama administration director of the National Institute of Health, he's a proponent of this melding of evolution.
Theistic evolution, yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that model? Is this something that should be, do we need to teach every theory of creation and evolution in the schools in order to make it somehow fair?
Many of my colleagues, I wouldn't use the word fair. This is a matter of political tactics, and many of my colleagues do feel that they need to make alliance with theistic evolutionists like Francis Collins, and I can see the political expediency of that. It's not my way. I mean, I care too much about the truth to compromise, and so I'm not going to say something like, "Oh, don't worry, you can go on believing in God and believing in evolution. They're totally compatible. They have nothing to say to each other." I don't actually believe that. But I'm happy to join with bishops, and indeed I have in Britain, in fighting against particularly egregious examples of creationist subversion of education.
Your successor at Oxford as the new professor of public understanding of science has decided to kind of try to push the religious issue a little bit more under the rug. What do you feel?
Well, he's a mathematician,
right?
And he's obviously going to promote mathematics rather than science, and it may well be that the conflict is less obvious. I mean, in my case, since my subject is evolutionary biology, we are in a way that my branch of biology is in the frontline trench, and whereas mathematics isn't, and so that would be entirely understandable that he would not be interested in that particular agenda.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is an atheist, of course, but
right.
He's not going to push that.
Do you see religion as being something that just is never going to go away? I mean, if we sort of project human civilization 200, 300, 1,000 years into the future, mythical understanding of the universe has been a deep-rooted part of the human species since we began. Obviously, because
we've been... I don't really know, because if you were to go back 100 years or 200 years, you would find far fewer atheists than now. Far fewer. I mean, actually hardly any. And now there are a lot in countries like Sweden and Denmark. They're probably in a majority. In America even, which is said to be such a religious country, I forget what the figure is, but there are far more atheists plus agnostics plus secularists than there are, for example, religious Jews. That's a very surprising fact to many people, because one thinks, you know, one knows an awful lot of religious Jews and they seem to have a lot of influence. Atheists are far more numerous, but they don't throw their weight about. They lower their voices. They don't lobby to nearly the same extent congressmen and so on, so they don't have the same influence. But they are quite numerous and steadily becoming more so. And so I am more optimistic about the future than many people.
One of the reasons it's difficult for atheists to speak up and be very vocal about their positions is simply because they're up against something that can't really be reasoned with in a way. I mean, there's the faith-based community will only go so far before they just claim, oh, it's faith,
we're not going to talk anymore. Yes, we excuse ourselves from the conversation.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, that is, you're right, that's hard to combat. It is, on one level, an unanswerable argument. Okay, can't talk anymore, that's faith. You've just got to believe that I believe it, and that I don't have to give a reason because it's faith. Well, as Dan Dennett says, they have simply said they are excused from the conversation. Go away and come back when you've got something to say.
What's next for you, Professor Dawkins?
I'm writing a children's book about science I'm trying to teach children the beauty of science, the beauty of the real world as appreciated by science. And I'm looking forward to doing that.
As you said before, it's almost a violation of human rights that we indoctrinate children. So,
well, I find it a violation of human rights that we label children with the religion of their parents.
Right.
And do we actually talk about something like a Catholic child? I think that is child abuse, because the child should be allowed to grow up and make her own mind up when she's old enough to decide. It should not be assumed to the point of actually tying a label around her neck, Catholic child or Muslim child, that this child automatically should be classified as having the same opinions about morality and the cosmos as her parents.
I recently visited my nephew, who just started talking, he's 16 months, and some of his first words were, pray to Jesus. You know, you see something being that, you know, you're so formidable at those ages, and you see something like that being impressed upon them so young, that seems like it's something very difficult to get rid of. And the movement is growing, from what I understand. So
you're suggesting that a child like that has been taught to say, pray to Jesus?
I don't think he has any idea what it means.
No.
But he's being taught that, you know, it's starting that young, that some of his first formulations of language have to do with...
I think there's something really creepy about that.
Oh, it's horrifically creepy.
It's not quite as bad as the film Jesus... what's it called? Jesus Camp.
Oh, yes. Jesus Camp. Yeah, it's a horrifically creepy film,
Yes.
I'll end with... I just want to ask you one more question. I wanted to hear your thoughts about Ardi, the recent discovery of the Ardipithecus.
Yes, Ardipithecus ramidus was actually discovered quite a while ago now, about 15
right.
years, I think. But just this week, a whole lot of papers about it have come out. It is a very interesting creature. It, like Australopithecus, it could be thought of as an upright-walking chimpanzee-sized brain, upright-walking. It's more chimpanzee-like in that it has an opposable toe. So although it walked on its hind legs, it walked with the big toe splayed out as a thumb. It was quite small and is a plausible ancestor of Australopithecus and Australopithecus, the plausible ancestor of us, it does fill a gap as a link to the common ancestor with chimpanzees, which probably lived about 7 million years ago. Ardipithecus lived about 4.4 million years ago. So it's a very exciting fossil and doesn't change anything very radical, but it fits in very beautifully with what one had already thought.
Well, Professor Dawkins, thank you so much for taking this time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A Conversation with Richard Dawkins. I'm Eric Jorgensen. I spoke to Professor Dawkins in October of this year at the Heathman Hotel. Professor Dawkins' newest book is The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution. Thank you so much for listening, and Merry Christmas.